Bien, donc nous voici réunis pour la dernière partie de ce colloque. Là, je dois dire, la journée a passé vraiment comme un éclair. Comme nous le disions tout à l'heure, nous nous rapprochons dangereusement non seulement d'un passé très récent, mais pratiquement de l'actualité. Nous finissons sur la Chine, parce que évidemment c'est difficile de parler de l'Asie sans parler de la Chine. Mon regret, je peux déjà le dire, c'est que nous n'avons pas eu d'intervention sur la Corée, mais y a insisté Christopher Gosha, c'est vraiment work in progress, c'est-à-dire c'est vraiment un colloque qui ouvre une nouvelle thématique de recherche, donc nous aurons l'occasion largement de compléter le tableau. Alors, je suis entourée, là c'est vraiment une très grande émotion pour moi, d'être entourée alors des deux grands camarades chinois spécialistes donc de la Chine contemporaine, qui ont non seulement beaucoup travaillé sur le maoïsme, mais qui l'ont vraiment vécu en direct en quelque sorte. Ce sont vraiment deux figures inséparables et qui ont beaucoup travaillé ensemble, qui ont créé la remarquable revue que je ne cesse de recommander, Perspectives chinoises, créée donc au CEFC de Hong Kong, qui a commencé un petit peu dans l'exercice un peu du China Watching et qui est maintenant une des sources d'informations les plus fiables sur ce qui se passe en Chine. S'ils me permettent cette référence un petit peu pour les amis, Michel Bonin à ma droite, Jean-Philippe Béja à ma gauche sont connus comme les ninjas. Donc, voilà. Bien. Alors, nous allons commencer donc avec Michel Bonin, directeur d'études à l'EHESS, qui va nous parler de la violence politique. Oh, I'm sorry. I should speak English. I'm sorry. So, Michel Bonin will talk about Mao's specific brand of political violence. Jean-Philippe Béja, to whom we should be thankful for being here, because he wrote an email to me yesterday, saying that he was in bed with 39 degrees, you know, fever, you know, and I said, you beat all the records in France, you see, of temperature. He made the valorous effort of being with us today, and he's going to talk about the state violence in post-Mao China. So I just suggest that they shall speak just one after the other, and we'll take the questions afterwards. So half an hour each, all right?
Okay. I thank Anshang for giving me the opportunity to exchange with distinguished Asian scholars and public on a topic which I often raise with my students, especially since the last 4 years when I teach Cultural Revolution at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, but on which I've never written a specific paper. When Anne asked me if I would like to speak about political violence, I said I thought that immediately that Mao Zedong was certainly the best, the best example possible. He was a perfect choice, since political violence was central to Maoism, theoretically and practically. Not only was he convinced about the necessity of political violence, but he was also a genius to find situations in which violence could develop to the full. I shall first briefly present the different types of and the main examples of Maoist violence, and as they appeared all along his political life. And I shall give more details, of course, about the Cultural Revolution. And I will try then to determine the specificity of Maoist violence and reflect on its role in Mao's political system. And finally, I want to ask if this specificity makes him more or less criminal than other dictators of the 20th century. As a communist revolutionary, Mao considered violence as necessary for the toppling of what he called the half-capitalist, half-feudalistic system in his country. So the Chinese Communist Party was founded in Shanghai in 1921, and the CCP tried to imitate the Soviet Party, but it had to fight 28 years before gaining power in 1949, which is very different from the history of access of the Soviet Party to power. And during that time, the CCP was not able to foment a revolution among workers in the cities, but had to retreat in rural mountainous regions to create rural red zones and fight against the attacks of the Kuomintang army, the Kuomintang being the party in power. Finally, thanks to the Japanese invasion, the Kuomintang had to make an alliance with the CCP, which survived and prospered during the war, and after the war was able, with the help of the Soviet Union, to defeat the Kuomintang and take power. Mao became the leader of the party during the difficult period of the Long March. He was able then, after that, to stabilize his position in the red zone of Yan'an by using a mix of political violence against potential rivals who were denounced as traitors and political indoctrination to convince the rank and file that he was a savior and that they had to obey him lest they become counter-revolutionaries. Mao at that time was very much inspired by Stalin, but the methods he used were not entirely those of Stalin. They were influenced by the examples of mass violence that Mao had observed in February 1927 during the peasant movement in his native province of Hunan. In the report he later presented to the Central Committee of the Party, you can find a highly positive description of the collective humiliation, beatings, and killings of landlords and other class enemies that he had observed, and a passionate plea for this kind of revolutionary actions. The most famous sentence in this report, which became a Maoist maxim and was chanted frenetically by the Red Guards during the Cultural Revolution, was "Revolution is not a dinner party." Jean-Philippe made a reference to the tragedy of Shanghai when Chiang Kai-shek began to kill communists in April 1927. And sometimes people thought that, well, the Chinese Communist Party became violent because they were attacked by the Kuomintang. But in fact, this passionate plea for violence in this report on the Hunan peasant movement, which I encourage you to read. If you read only one text of Mao, you have to read this one. Is anterior to the attack on the communists by the Kuomintang. It was presented to the Central Committee of the Communist Party in March 1927. So Mao didn't have to wait for Chiang Kai-shek to learn about violence. After the revolution of 1949, Mao copied the Soviet system and inherited all this. And I want just to say to, because Christopher Gosha spoke about showed us these photos of the revolutionary wars in Vietnam. It's exactly what happened in 1927 in Hunan. So I think that they were all students of Mao, and Mao were the students of this peasant rebellion. Of course, this peasant rebellion was also encouraged by the communists and the Kuomintang going to the north in the famous Beifa, what do you say in
Northern
English?
Expedition.
North Expedition. To take back power from the warlords. So this it had already a political meaning, but it was really a peasant rebellion, and Mao was absolutely fascinated by this kind of violence. And after the revolution, so Mao copied the Soviet system and inherited all the Stalinist organs of repression, secret police, party-controlled judiciary, labor camps, etc. He also had a propaganda department which transmitted to the cadres and the population his latest directives and a bureaucracy in charge of their implementation. But in the socialist transformation of the country, he relied mainly on mass movements. Those so-called mass movements are not to be confused with spontaneous social movements. All of them were organized and manipulated by the party, which sent special work groups to the grassroots when the local party committee was considered as an insufficient force to lead the movements. Those movements were all directed at enemies of the people, which were to be denounced first by the local or sent down authorities, but also by the rest of the population. The participation of the masses was important to justify the movement, to isolate those targeted, and to give the false impression that it was spontaneous. In each case, it was considered essential that the enemies reflect on themselves and present an apology before receiving their punishment. These self-confessions were generally obtained under duress, ranging from endless harassment and detention to mere physical torture. The first mass movement after the establishment of the PRC was the land reform. One of the rationales of the revolution was to liberate the peasants from the landlords and rich peasants so that ordinary peasants have enough land to sustain themselves. In the history of China, peasant rebellions had rarely been directed against other peasants, including the landlords. They were directed against the state, whatever its form, because it imposed taxes. So the land reform had to be organized and manipulated by scores of party members, which were sent to the countryside. Very often they had to force the peasants to take part. Some rehearsals were organized, and the party promised advantages to the most zealous activists. But of course, after some time, existing bad feelings and against the former rich and powerful, as well as the hope of obtaining part of their land, were enough to guarantee participation and even zeal. In fact, these methods used during the land reform were largely based on the methods loaded by Mao in his report of 1927. The result was violent, with probably 2 million dead or more, and the creation of a new pariah class in the countryside, which would be systematically discriminated against until Mao's death. So of course, through the land reform, the party had, in a way, sealed a blood pact with the peasants. And In exchange of their participation, the activists became local leaders of the party, and most peasants obtained more land to cultivate. Unfortunately for them, the land was taken back by the authorities after a few years and became the property of collective entities controlled by the party, cooperatives and later communes. Other mass movements of the 1950s and 60s were more or less organized on the same model, but after the consolidation of the party structure, the party committees were more active and the participation of the masses, although important, was less violent. The violence was left to the institutional organs of repression. But I think a special attention has to be given to the most lethal mass movement organized by Mao and probably by anyone in world history, the Great Leap Forward, launched in 1958. Paradoxically, the movement was not at the start targeting physical enemies, but was a huge mobilization of the whole population, especially in the countryside, to make agriculture and industry leap forward. The problem is that the whole rural society was reorganized along Mao's fanciful ideas in order to extract from the peasants an amount of labor never witnessed before. And you can say that the whole of China was transformed into a big army where everybody has to obey the man in charge above and work without limit. So that was the way that Mao wanted to make the industry and agriculture of China leap forward. The extremely optimistic economic targets fixed by Mao, as well as the ways to attain them, were totally unscientific, and the result was an incredible waste of resources and human labor, which triggered the biggest famine in the history of humanity. Probably around 35 million dead. Mao had pressured all provincial cadres so that they accept those ridiculous targets. The problem could have been much less severe if Mao had accepted at the Lushan Plenum in 1959 to change his policy. But confronted to the reality of the famine by a private letter from the Minister of Defense, he denied it and accused those who pleaded for a change of orientation of being rightists. For the peasants dying of hunger, there was no way out, since they were prohibited to leave their villages, contrary to what had always been the surviving practice in Chinese history. And since Mao needed to find scapegoats for the catastrophe that he had brought onto his country, he declared that class enemies, infiltrated among the local rural cadres, had sabotaged the Great Leap. This is why, among the 35 or 36 million dead, about 2 million did not die of hunger and exhaustion like the others, but were local cadres executed as counter-revolutionaries, generally because they had alerted the higher authorities about the terrible plight of their fellow peasants. The Great Leap, then, shows that utopia, when it is imposed by a dictator through violent means, can be even more dangerous than political violence launched against specific enemies. Although the Cultural Revolution, officially the period from 1966 to 1976, was not quantitatively as lethal as the Great Leap Forward, it is qualitatively the richest period as regards political violence, especially during the years 1966-1971. This revolution was a kind of unidentified political object which was planned and launched by Mao Zedong. It was a purge, but not only a purge. It was also an attempt at transforming the system established after 1949 and also the minds of the young people through a stage revolution, which with the assumed risk of civil war. Altogether, it was an attempt at securing the revolutionary character of the regime in order to guarantee Mao's role in history even after his death. It began with a spectacular form of political violence, that of the Red Guards. High school and university students encouraged by Mao to fight his enemies, beginning by the old culture represented by their teachers, school principals, and all established intellectuals, professors, writers, and artists. The model proposed to them was that of the Hunan peasant movement, as described in Mao's report already mentioned. At that time, mainly between May and October 1966, only students of good class backgrounds were allowed to take part. In the 1950s, the whole population was divided into good class background and bad class background. And the good class background were, of course, first the leaders of the Communist Party and the army, and then the workers, and the bad class backgrounds were all those landowners, rich peasants, bourgeois, etc. So only students of good class backgrounds could take part at the beginning, and among them, the children of leaders or cadres of the party and the army were considered as natural leaders. The violence and the cruelty that they exhibited in the way they treated the people, as well as all kinds of monuments and works of art, is astonishing. We spoke about iconoclasm this morning. Of course, iconoclasm in China at that time was huge, was incredible. I mean, a large part of the Chinese cultural objects, monuments, statues, all kinds of artifacts were destroyed, simply destroyed. And of course, Zhou Enlai tried to save a few of them, especially the Jincheng, the palace, but. Even the image of Confucius, I mean the temple of Confucius and his grave was totally destroyed. So a lot of things were destroyed at that time, and I can't enter into the detail because I will give priority to the people, to the persons. The first teacher, who was killed by her students on August 5, 1966, was beaten and tortured for long hours by girls aged about 13, 15 years old. Some of the Red Guards in this school were daughters of high leaders, of the highest leaders. And the collective fanaticism of these young people was encouraged by Mao, who reviewed 12 million of them in 8 mass meetings organized at Tiananmen Square during the first few months. And the most famous picture of the Cultural Revolution is probably when Mao is given an armband of a Red Guard by a young girl. And this girl was the head of the Red Guards in this school where the principal had just been killed. Quite a number of famous writers and artists were killed or committed suicide to evade unbearable humiliations and tortures, and many other less known teachers and people of bad class origin, surviving former capitalists and all kinds of people considered bad, whose name and addresses were given to the Red Guards by the police, so were also the target of this kind of violence and met the same fate. The cruelty of those urban and educated young people of the higher strata has been a topic of discussion for Chinese intellectuals and foreign scholars. It shows undoubtedly that human morality is quite dependent upon a civilized environment and formal social and legal restrictions. When those are absent, collective violence can become uncontrollable, especially when those who would refuse to participate could very well become themselves targets. But for Mao, this was the beginning of the Cultural Revolution, but then for Mao, terrorizing intellectuals and people of bad class origins was just an appetizer. There were more important targets, namely most of the party leaders, especially those linked with Liu Shaoqi, number two, who was the highest target of Mao, but at the time he himself didn't know, as well as the whole bureaucracy, especially because it was considered as revisionist. To attack them, Mao could not rely on the first Red Guards because they were the children of those people that he wanted to attack. So he had to breed a new kind of Red Guards, who would be called the rebels, Zaofanpai. And so the rebels specialized in attacking political leaders. And at the end of the year 1966, for his 73rd birthday, Mao had a dinner, and during the dinner he toasted to the coming nationwide all-round civil war. So you have the number one, I mean the person in charge of at the time more than 800 million people, who decides the beginning of a civil war. And indeed, this is what happened the next year, in 1967 and even in 1968. Of course, I do not have time to describe all the forms of political violence, but the main scenario was that of young rebels attacking all official institutions and trying to seize power as ordered by Mao, but entering into bloody fighting because different groups wanted to seize the same power. And at the end, generally, it ended up by having two groups of rebels fighting each other to death. And all in the name of Mao, all pretending to defend Mao against his enemies. And so Mao, to overcome this problem, decided to entrust the army with the role of choosing the left and the right and helping the left. But of course the army leaders, they supported those who were obedient, who obeyed the army, and they didn't even themselves know who was the left and who was the right. And then after some time, they had the means of repression, and so many groups almost disappeared, and they were repressed, imprisoned, beaten, even killed. But then Mao decided that he didn't want this. So he prohibited the army from using their weapons. So immediately, all the rebels who had been repressed went back and attacked the army and took their weapons. And then they used their weapons to attack their enemies among the rebels and even attack the army. And also at that time, some parts of the army decided to help to support different groups. So there was a risk that the different armies would fight each other, which would be the total chaos. And so at the end, Mao decided that there was no way, alternative way as to give the, as to authorize the army to use their weapons again. And then when they were authorized to use their weapons, then they crushed the rebels and they took revenge. And it was the worst massacre. I mean, the number of people killed by the army and by the militia was much higher than the people who were killed by the Red Guards or the rebels. And so in this last part, which was the most lethal part of the Cultural Revolution, the Cultural Revolution got to the countryside. Before that, the countryside was generally out of the fighting. But it arrived in the countryside at the end of the 1968. And at that time, there was in the countryside collective massacres, which were really bordering genocide against the survivors of the four bad classes. I mean, this pariah category, which was determined in the 1950s. And so since, because Mao had launched a movement which was called the Cleansing the Class Ranks movement. So they had to cleanse the class ranks. So, of course, those of recorded bad class origin, they were the first victims. And this killing was really something like the pogroms, because it was generally, it was practiced in broad daylight, people, and by neighbors. The neighbors came and killed those neighbors. They had lived in peace for 18 years after the land reform, and they just killed them. And the worst is probably that in some places in the south of China, there was even cannibalism. Cannibalism by hatred. Which is not the cannibalism by hunger. It's totally different. And so the people had the impression that they had to eat their enemies, the class enemies, especially, and also it was a tradition, a very old tradition of eating the heart, the liver, and the reproductive organs of enemies to absorb their strength. So this happened, especially in Guangxi, and this was never seriously punished. Chinese journalist went in the beginning of the 80s to do an inquiry. He got some archives. And also, he went to interview people, and he published this, in the, of course, in Hong Kong and in the United States, and you have the photo of a cannibal who says, "Well, this was normal because Chairman Mao had said that if we don't kill enemies, they will kill us," and. And he discussed this very, very simply, and discussing if roasted meat was better than boiled meat, and all this. So this is what happened in 1968 in China. So when you look at all this, and you see also that at that time, the worst part, the most cruel part of the Cultural Revolution, it was also the period where the cult of Mao reached incredible stage. Mao was really becoming a god. People spoke to him every morning when they woke up, and they reported to him, just using a portrait on the wall, they reported to him at the end of the day, and apologizing for not being revolutionary enough. And when people spoke, you know, when they wrote to their parents and saying, beginning with maxims of the quotations of Chairman Mao and all this, I mean, it was, and people were dancing a few times a day, the dances of loyalty, loyalty to Chairman Mao. So it was really a quasi-religion. So in a way, when you look at this, you feel that at that time, China had gone back to a primitive stage of human civilization, when rationality was absent and replaced by blind worship of a stern god giving protection only to those who practiced human sacrifices for him. Okay, after this very limited overview of political violence under Mao, I would like to stress 2 points. First, political violence was central to Maoism. It was necessary not only militarily to topple the existing power, but also symbolically to destroy radically the image of the exploitative people, of the dominant people of the old regime. Hence Mao's insistence on the necessary humiliation of the class enemies and the necessity to force them to acknowledge their crimes. But the violence was also necessary to maintain the revolutionary purity of the regime, to prevent its decay, to cleanse it, as we have seen in the cleansing class ranks campaign. You have to purify. And what is striking, in fact, when you look at Mao's history is that his brand of communism, it is the fact that he refused to turn the page of the revolution and to concentrate on economic development and state building. He felt that his own personal power and his place in history were insolubly linked to the transformation of his country and of his people according to his will and to his imagination. He could not accept to become a manager, a position for which he had no talent, especially compared to other leaders like Liu Shaoqi or Deng Xiaoping. And to remain a revolutionary, he needed enemies and political violence. Hence the notion of continuous revolution, which he defended during the Cultural Revolution. To continue revolution, he needed, of course, class enemies of the new brand. And this is why he promoted the idea of the existence of capitalists at the top of the party, as well as in the rest of society, even though there was no possible economic or social basis for the supposed bourgeoisie. So if continuous political violence was a necessity for Mao, this violence was also quite specific. Mao's special brand of leadership among the communist leaders of the world was his outstanding technique of manipulation of the masses, for which he had developed a special know-how during the 20 years of fighting in remote mountainous regions. It is significant that Carl Schmitt, I have already mentioned him, the once Nazi political thinker, whose main idea was that the question of politics was to define the enemy. So that's politics, and he says that this is what Mao thinks too. You know, so Carl Schmitt is ecstatic about Mao. He thinks he finds a brother in Mao. you know? And this text, The Theory of the Partisan, written in 1963, in this text he presents Mao as the model of the partisan for whom hostility is absolute, to a point that even Clausewitz would not have been able to imagine. Schmidt's knowledge of Chinese history was, however, very limited. As I have said, he didn't know that, in fact, the civil war in China was not a guerrilla warfare. It was a conventional war, helped with the know-how, the military know-how that people like Lin Biao had learned in Moscow, and also with a lot of Soviet weapons. But still, it is true that Mao has spent his life reflecting on the way to defeat enemies through all sorts of means. So in a way, Carl Schmitt was right, that to find him close to him. So maybe I finish with the question of responsibility. This question is often overlooked, but what is the personal responsibility of Mao Zedong in the appalling violence of the post-1949 and especially post-1966 China? There is sometimes a tendency to exonerate him under the pretext that he didn't order directly all the evil actions perpetrated at that time. The responsibility then was that of the people who perpetrated them. This is, in my view, an erroneous conception. And I would argue that, in fact, Mao can be considered as more criminal than his fellow tyrants of the 20th century, Stalin and Hitler. There are two reasons to justify my argument, and they are both clearly closely linked. First, instead of entrusting specialized institutions with the task of implementing his repressive orders against all kinds of enemies, Mao enrolled the whole population in this task, through those so-called mass movements in which ordinary people were to denounce verbally and, in some cases, attack physically the enemies designated more or less vaguely by himself. The consequence was that many more people became perpetrators than in the institutional model. And victims were also more numerous than if they had been clearly chosen by Mao and by repressive organs like police. Because the people entrusted with the repressive tasks, ordinary people, activists, and local cadres, were eager to show their zeal and their revolutionary spirit, either to advance their career or simply to avoid being themselves considered as suspect. Secondly, and it's a result, not only more people perpetrated evil criminal actions, but the social traumas were more difficult, in fact, impossible to cure. In the Maoist model, in which former perpetrators often became victims at the next round, hatred and hopes for revenge became predominant inside society. Grievances of almost everyone against everyone, inside neighborhoods, work units, even inside families. Because as you know, during the Cultural Revolution, children were very much encouraged to denounce their parents. And some of them denounced them until they were killed. And so all this created a situation that was so complicated that it didn't allow for acknowledgement of past wrongdoings and reconciliation. So if we take the example of the Cultural Revolution, we can see that as a result of Mao's fake revolution, I would call this a fake revolution, fake is a mot à la mode, but it's really a fake revolution. When a revolution is decided by the emperor, you cannot only say that it's a fake revolution. Most of the population was engulfed in a maelstrom of violence where many had to play the part that was written down for them by Mao, either as perpetrators, victims, or often, very often, both alternately. The traumas left by this period have never been healed. And this is not only because the leaders were afraid of damaging the legitimacy of the party, and that they discourage the study and the discussion about the Cultural Revolution. But it's also because many people could not face their own past, or were afraid of opening up the Pandora box of pent-up hatred. So, I don't know if, I don't have time. So, I would just maybe conclude by saying that during the Cultural Revolution, the responsibility of the totalitarian system, and then, of course, of his great helmsman and those who supported him, was clearly essential. That is why the Gao brothers' statue, the Gao brothers are two artists who have created a statue of Mao kneeling and begging for forgiveness from the Chinese people. This is extremely symbolic, but of course, very few people know about it in China because it's a big taboo, and it's very. Sometimes I show it to my students from mainland in China, and they are shocked. You know, they can't accept this. You know, but in fact, it is in. From a historical point of view, it is much more reasonable than Mao's portrait hanging at the top of the Tiananmen rostrum or his statues still erected on Chinese soil, showing for eternity the way to the future. Okay, I finished this.